like a thief in the night. Stand in front of the masterpiece, and I can't tell you why. It hurts so much to be in love with a masterpiece. And I'm right by your side, like a thief in the night.
Hello and welcome to In the Mood for Podcast with Callum Reid of Ultimate Addict and Pete Shepherd of inthemoodforblog.blog.co.uk.
Hello.
Welcome to week six.
Yeah, still at it.
Yeah, they can't stop us.
No, much like Mr. Federer at the weekend, we can't be stopped.
Yeah, however valued the effort.
Yes, yes, yes. And a quick little thought for... congratulations to all the Wimbledon champions, and a thought for Elena Vesnina before Mr. Murray, because she's just lost for her third Wimbledon final in a row. Poor dear.
Yeah, in the doubles, right?
Yes, yes. She's been the last two mixed doubles finals, and 3 years ago she was in the women's doubles, and Zvonareva lost the plot.
She'll get there.
Yeah, she will. She will.
But it's nice to see the papers weren't too harsh on him today, that I saw.
Yeah, I don't think they really can be, because...
No, not after yesterday.
No, okay.
Equally sad news, Ernest Borgnine died, 95 years old.
That is a good innings.
Yeah.
95 is a very good innings.
Yes. Oscar winner for Marty...
One of the rare times where someone won the Oscar for their best performance, I think.
Yeah.
He was lovely in that film.
Yeah, he's good in From Here to Eternity as well. Pretty good.
Yes, yeah, forgotten about that one. And let's hope he's watching Brokeback Mountain in that big cinema in the sky.
Yeah. Might be better on a second run around.
Possibly.
Okay, so we're going to start by talking about the recent rule changes with BAFTA and Oscar.
Mm-hmm.
They review them kind of annually when they can be bothered and tweak little things. So we'll start with the Oscars. They've added hairstyling to the makeup category.
Thank God.
Yeah, because it is styling, isn't it?
It's part of it, and I think they've just been way behind the times on this one, and it's long overdue.
Well, how long have BAFTA had hairstyling involved? It's been a while, hasn't it?
At least since the last time they rejigged the awards, which was 2004.
Yeah.
At least since then.
Yeah, so that's a welcome change. We've got foreign language film category. Films must be submitted in 35mm or DCP. What's digital? DCP?
Digital something projection, I would assume.
Cinematic? Oh.
Whatever.
Yeah, well, they would be anyway, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I think in the past that they did have a... you did have some really, really low budget ones that were blown up to 16mm.
Would you think... like that Uruguayan one, Silent House, is it?
Yeah, the one that was shot with a camera.
Yeah, would that not count?
Yeah, that was sent last year. That was their submission. That was okay. Sometimes what you have to do in the past is if you've recorded it in one way, so for example, if you've recorded it in on digital, then you'd have to submit it in 16mm or 35 or whatever, you'd have to do a print. But then sometimes it's actually, if you haven't already got the print, it's a very expensive job to actually put one together. So with this now, they're basically saying digital's fine, that'll work.
Yeah, well, most films are digital now, so
yeah, it's so
it makes sense. So another sensible decision.
Yes. Unusually.
We've got the visual effects category. Nominees are going to be selected from a shortlist of 10. It could have been between 7 and 10 before, so that's not changed much.
Right.
lots of visual effects films, so fair enough.
Yeah, so there's just basically more to go, more for them to choose from in the final shenanigans.
And the last thing is they've allowed additional songwriters to be credited on the original song category, because that was clearly the main thing wrong with the original song category.
Really? Was that the main thing? I think the list of things that were wrong with the original song category, we'd be here all night reading off those.
Maybe it's existence in the first place.
Well, A, it's complete lack of relevance in the modern day, considering we don't have musicals anymore, and that's what it was originally created for. But B, people don't write... there are things that have won this award that broke many of the Oscars rules, and they just don't care. So,
yeah, that goes way back as well.
Yeah, oh, it's been happening for a very long time.
Because you're not supposed to have the song in the film itself, are you? Like,
you can, but if it's either got to be in the film in its entirety, or it has to be the first piece in the credits.
Yeah.
So, for example, last year Madonna got Golden Globe nominated for her song for WE, but she was ineligible at the Oscars because the song comes about a minute or so into the credits.
Right.
And it's got to start straight away. It's got to be like The Wrestler. Film stops, song starts. Credits roll, song starts.
Yeah. But... I came around to Masterpiece, actually, because I didn't like it at first, but I think it's quite good now.
Can't say I've listened to it too many times. Can't claim that one. Although I did see the film this week, finally.
Yeah. Sum it up in one word, if you can.
Questionable.
Okay. Should we move on to BAFTA?
Yeah, so BAFTA have the big thing is that the main thing that you'd think initially is that they've got rid of one of the rounds of voting. It has been until recently that there are three rounds. You vote for the first one, which produces a long list. Basically, you wrote down 12 per category. 12 things per category,
yeah.
And then a long list of 15 was created, and the nominees could only come from those 15. And then so then there was a second round, and those 15 were narrowed down to 5 in each category. And then in the final round, you vote for the winners. What they're doing now is essentially deep six the long lists, so you're not going to be able to see that anymore. And I personally really used to like the long list because it actually showed you what was on their radar,
but it basically told you what the nominees were going to be before they
especially when they actually put stars by which, because you had the
chapter
it tells you which ones were voted for by the actors, but then it didn't really matter because it was everybody who was voting, but it would ended up being that about only one person per category would miss.
But when you looked at the long list, some of the decisions were terrible, like Rachel McAdams, Midnight in Paris.
Well, yeah, there were some just outrageous fillers down the years on there, and also some outrageous omissions. So you see some that you just think, hang on, you didn't even get on the long list, what the hell's going on? But it also shows you what they're actually using as filler films, how you'd have like Burn After Reading getting like 10 or 12 long listed mentions.
Yeah.
So it did show you what they were using to pad them out at the very least.
So it's going
to
be more of a surprise maybe this time around.
Yes. That's the first thing, that they've got rid of one of the rounds. The second thing is that they are changing who votes for the actual main awards. What used to happen was that, and it's changed a little bit over the years because they've been tinkering it, but essentially the only awards that everybody voted for was Best Picture and Acting.
Yeah.
Those are the only ones that everyone voted for. So for everything else, from director down to art direction and best music, everything else was actually the winners were voted for by the respective chapter. So all the cinematographers vote for the cinematography, all the production designers vote for the production design award, etc., etc., etc. What BAFTA did a few years ago to tinker with that was to which was a stupidly bad idea, was to do it basically the opposite way to the way the Oscars do it. And the way the Oscars do it is they have every chapter vote for the nominees and then everyone can vote for the winners.
Yeah.
BAFTA had the bright idea about 3 or 4 years ago to think, you know what, we're going to have everyone who's not qualified to actually realise what this is. They're going to vote for the nominees and then we're going to send it back to the people who've got a clue.
Yeah.
And they're going to vote for the winners.
That's ludicrous. Absolutely ludicrous. Yeah.
The chapters are voting for the winners, and you can opt in, and they're encouraging people to opt out of voting if they don't actually think that they're qualified. Why they don't introduce this just in general,
yeah.
I don't know. Individual chapters will now decide the nominees, and members will vote for the winner. So this is the thing. Members are going to vote for the screenplays, the cinematography, the costume design, director, editing, makeup, everything. So in that respect, it's like the Oscars.
Yeah,
that's what they're doing now.
And everybody can nominate for the main five for the picture and acting.
Yeah,
that's not and the chapters nominating. That's everybody nominating.
No,
still.
And this is why it's a really bad idea that now you've got the whole members voting on the winners. 2 years ago, people went wild when the King's Speech won everything except for Best Director. And so then all of a sudden, David Fincher won Best Director for The Social Network, and people who didn't realise how the BAFTA system went, they thought, oh, David Fincher's going to win the Oscar then, because even the British didn't think he was the best director. No, that's not true. The directors of BAFTA voted for Dave Fincher that year.
Yes.
And if under these rules, Dave Fincher, and personally, I don't mind, I wouldn't mind this, but under these current rules, Dave Fincher wouldn't win. Tom Hooper would win the BAFTA.
Yeah, that's true.
Because everyone's voting. And you may think, okay, well, you're splitting hairs between the film that was probably second everywhere else. But in 1999, Sam Mendes did not win the BAFTA for American Beauty. And so initially you think, oh, well, that's...
Who was that then?
Almodovar. How I Met Your Mother. All About My Mother. And... So that doesn't happen now anymore, and so one of BAFTA's most inspired decisions doesn't happen anymore. They're opting in for foreign language, which okay, fine, it's a bit overdue.
Yeah. So what does that mean?
That's the good thing. What that means is that you're more likely to have. It means no more Marion Cotillard wins the BAFTA for Le Môme and Le Môme wins foreign language. It also probably means that something like you don't see Christine Scott Thomas getting. You still see Christine Scott Thomas getting nominated for I've Loved You So Long, but it doesn't win foreign language. Because it's going to be a group of opt-ins, and they're not just going to vote for the one that they've seen.
Right. Okay. Okay. Well, that's
so
good then.
So some's good, some's bad.
I think generally, Oscar system is better in terms of voting for the winners versus the nominees.
Yes.
You're always going to get people voting who aren't qualified to vote. So. They may as well have the nominees put forward by people who know what they're talking about, and then.
But the BAFTA are doing that in a lot of them. So all the ones from screenplay down are chapters doing the noms and then members voting, but they've still got free rein on acting. If you were in charge of any of these awards, what would be the big thing you'd do, or would you do anything big?
I think I would definitely change the song for us. That, I yep. think that's yep. the problem. The way that people vote on the song from 1 to 10, wherein you can sabotage a song by putting it 1 out of 10,
mm-hmm.
and the ridiculous, like, they have to get a minimum score of 7.63 or something to be nominated. So you end up with 2 nominees, as in last year.
Yeah, that was stupid.
Neither of which were that great. So yeah. So what would yours be? Foreign language.
Oh well. I'm gonna go the opposite here. What I would do is I would turn the Oscars into the American equivalent of the Césars, and I would ban anything that isn't an American production, because if you're only gonna have the slightest of token. And this is really the wrong year for me to say this, considering the artist won. but in general, over the years, it is not impossible to get nominated if you're not an American film, but it is impossible to get nominated if you don't have American financing, at least for your consideration campaigns and what have you. And it is literally between 10 and 15% of the acting nominations come from films that don't have some kind of American backing at the beginning, regardless of the distribution side of things.
Yeah, the problem is that it's being seen as a global thing now.
Yeah, and that's why I'd change it, because it really, 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 really isn't. And it is purely down to what you've... how much money is going on the campaign and whether you've got the backing to begin with.
Very LA-centric. The voting bodies, you know, very LA-centric. So they're always going to vote for films like that where they're from.
Oh, yeah, of course. And that's a natural thing. And so that's what I'd say is if you're at least BAFTA have, I think BAFTA average about 1 foreign language performance a year. In the acting stakes, and Oscars about a third of that. You get about 1 every 3 or 4.
Yeah.
And it really, really is a token gesture. And so for me, if it's that, if it's going to be that paltry, and you're not going to take it seriously at all, and you're going to ask 6,000 people their opinion when they get DVDs sent through the door, I'd rather just stop the pretense. And because even something like when Cotillard won, she's the second woman to win for a foreign language performance after Sophia Loren. I don't think she was any better than, say, Isabelle Carré in Anna M, but because she's the one who's got the money behind her, and that's the one that gets pushed. And Isabelle Carré in that performance, it's rather like something that's been Oscar nominated before. It's like Glenn Close in Fatal Attraction. So it's not the sort of thing. It's not even the sort of thing they're not going to go for.
Yeah.
I'm not suggesting some random, some random art film, but it's literally that's how they get in.
Marion Cotillard was quite a rare Best Actress winner in the first place, though.
Very.
Considering the film came out in May, and it was foreign language.
That whole year was a mess.
Yeah, it was quite a good year in the end for actresses. But
everything came out early. You had Jolie in A Mighty Heart. You had Christie in
Away from Her.
Yeah, and those were like the early ones that you thought, well, we'll see if the year bombs, then they might have a chance. And they ended up being the front runners.
So you would absolutely overhaul this and just make it only American productions.
I'd rather have none than just the occasional one that. What makes you think, well, why was that one?
Hans Labyrinth.
or like The Artist. I mean, why was that the only French film that Harvey Weinstein deemed? I mean, The Artist really took off. The year before, he had Le Concert, and he didn't push it at all. That's a really crowd-pleasing film.
I think he did try and push it initially, and then it wasn't really happening.
Yeah. That's the thing. It's not down to him judging artistically what he thinks is the best, it's what's going to play well with the Americans.
Yeah.
And so that's why I personally. Another thing I would quite like to do, or be, I think would be an interesting one, is rather than this opt-in stuff, vote for whatever you want. Doesn't matter. Vote for whatever you want. But then, accompanying your thing, you actually say, they have the eligibility list. You just write down every single film you've seen, and you're saying, this is what I'm judging it from.
Yeah.
And so then, if you've got, I don't know, they've got 6,000 people in the Oscars. If you've got 1,000 people who've seen, let's say, for example, Maggie Gyllenhaal in Sherry Baby.
Yeah.
And of those 1,000 people, 750 put her number one, which is very, very unlikely, but let's just use that as an example. And then you've got, let's say, 5,000 people that year who've seen Little Children out of the 6,000, and 1,000 of them putting Kate Winslet number one.
Yeah.
I would want the percentage to matter more than the actual number, because in that scenario, Winslet gets more votes than Maggie Gyllenhaal, but only 20% of the people who saw that film actually thought she was the best of the year, whereas 3/4, think that Gyllenhaal is. And
that could that well that was probably 5th or 6th, wasn't it? So.
Well, it wasn't really. I'm not actually sure they campaigned all of it. I know they campaigned for the Globes. I'm not sure that DVD was out, and if it was, it might have only been for the acting branch. And the problem with that is that a lot of it, even the ones that only go for the acting branch, you need the word of mouth from the other Oscar members to get you to watch it. So one in six Oscar voters have that thing. If you're going, you're just talking to one of your friends who's also an Oscar voter, they're going to suggest you. Oh, did you see that one?
Yeah.
So that means you've got, I don't know, about over 80% of people who haven't seen Sherry Baby and aren't pimping it to the few people who actually did get the DVD through the door.
Yeah, but you need a wide selection of people to judge that from. You can't have like 85 people seeing a film.
That's the other thing. I think there'd have to be a qualification on it, a minimum number. Like maybe with Best Picture, you need the 5% to get in. Maybe you'd need at least 10% of the people voting to have actually seen it.
Yeah.
So maybe you need like a minimum number of the actual having been seen, which would still screw some of the foreign language things, but it would make it a lot more interesting, and it would be even less predictable than the current number one. Voting as it is,
it's a vicious circle.
It is.
So, shall we go from talking about the Oscars and BAFTAs to talking about Oscars and BAFTA nominees in the best exotic Marigold Hotel?
Chock full of them. Absolutely.
This is an all-star cast of British thespians
with Dev Patel.
Yeah.
There's an all-star cast and Dev Patel.
Has he got a with credit or an and?
I don't know, he might have.
Probably neither.
God. God. The reason we're talking about this, even though it was out a while ago, is because it is still kicking around at the independent cinemas around the country, and is out this week around by me.
Yeah, it's out on DVD as well, I think.
Yeah. And do you want to tell us what the film's about, Cal?
Yes. It's about a lot of old people, basically. the retired, elderly British people, 60s and 70s, and who all kind of decide to up sticks from England and move to India, kind of for an indefinite period. It doesn't really say if it's for good or not, does it? I think it just kind of...
No, it's a bit wishy-washy, yeah. Really.
It's not the only thing. And the hotel's run by Dev Patel, and the film stars Judi Dench, Maggie Smith, Bill Nye, Tom Wilkinson, Sir Tom Wilkinson, Celia Imrie, Penelope Wilton. Have I missed anybody?
Pickup. Is that his name, Ronald Pickup?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's directed by John Madden, Shakespeare in Love.
Before you say who.
Yeah. And Proof. I'm struggling. Yeah, Debt.
Did he? Oh, he did The Debt, didn't he?
Yeah.
So it's his fault. It's his fault that I had to watch a Sam Worthington film because I like Jessica Chastain. What a git.
Why couldn't you've gotten Helen Mirren again for this? Or is she just too cool?
Maybe she read the script. Because apparently Judi Dench doesn't.
That sounds likely.
Especially on this evidence.
Is it safe to say you were not a fan of the best exotic Marigold Hotel?
Actually, I'm just playing. I didn't dislike it. I didn't think it was good.
No.
But I didn't dislike it. It's hard to hate. It's thoroughly undemanding.
Yeah.
And of
its actors, especially, really.
Yeah, I mean, the only demanding thing that Tom Wilkinson has to do is do a nice cover drive left-handed. That's it.
I thought you were going to say something else there that was a spoiler.
No. Some of it's funny. I'm not going to lie. It did make me laugh a few times. I think less so with Maggie Smith's racist bigots.
Yeah, what was going on there? The Cockney accent as well, not good.
Yeah, it just reminded me of Crash in the way that when Crash came out, I went to see it at the cinema with someone, and it was just for me. It had a lot of lines in there that were designed for middle class white people to laugh at. How racist all these people were being. So I never took Crash seriously. I always thought this is quite obviously designed to be funny, and yet then suddenly at the end of the year, and you have people like bastions of non-criticism, i.e. detailing the plot of a film that is Roger Ebert, trying to say that this is a serious treatise on the subject of racism. I mean, please, come on. It's so many lines in that are obviously designed to be jokes.
Yeah.
And that's what I got here. It's not there to like show the underbelly of British society. It's there to get a load of white people laughing at how racist someone's been.
Yeah, and there were lots of old people. And old people, I don't mean to generalise, but they can be quite racist.
Well, yeah.
So I think this is where it was aiming with the target market, because it's not.
You just have to see films from the 60s. The racism was out. It was out. So if you got people who grew up in that society where it was not only acceptable, it was the norm.
Yeah.
It was expected.
it's the kind of film where it's expecting us to bat an eyelid because it's an old person who's being racist.
Yeah.
If it was a younger character, then there might be more criticism there. But regardless, I think it works better because it's well acted. Like, because some of the jokes are really quite terrible.
Yeah, Nye really, especially, he has some things which actually, if you looked at it on paper, that really wouldn't actually be that good a joke, but it's his delivery, the way he is, the chemistry he has, especially with Dench.
Yeah. He and Dench are probably the best in this.
This is the closest I've seen Dench act on film to how I've seen Dench be in interviews.
And maybe on TV too.
As
time goes by, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, how she made that whole telecommunication plot line go, I do not know.
It's.
She goes to run a call centre in the middle of Delhi. Yeah.
I mean, this is the thing. This is the failing of the plot. The plotting. The script seems to think that people's in this country's problem with telemarketers is that they don't. Yeah, is that they read through the scripts. No, the problem that people have with it is that you've got someone who can barely speak English. Who sounds like a foreigner calling you, and they don't want it, they wouldn't want it, and it's always for something that you've already got or you don't want. The problem isn't that the way that they talk to you, it's the fact that you've got someone foreign talking to you. That's the problem.
I think you got the impersonality of it right. Like, she was trying to give them more personality, but the way that she's kind of like thrust into that line of work, because we see her at the beginning struggling to understand this person. She's trying to connect to Modem or something, isn't she?
Mm.
And it all kind of stems from that one conversation she's had.
Yeah, well, this is the thankless task that this group has. You've got all these disparate, probably about half a dozen disparate different people who you've got to execute their immediate, why they would want to or have to leave Britain to go to this geriatric people's home run by slumdogs. Literally, because literally, by that I mean by Dev Patel.
Yeah, Dev Patel isn't bad in this.
He wasn't, and very few people disliked his performance in Slumdog Millionaire quite as much as I did. But he was funny. There were some funny moments, and he wasn't atrocious.
Yeah.
What? Small praise, but praise nonetheless.
Although his plotline relationship.
So insipid.
Yeah, that was just clumsy.
The stuff with the mum, it's just so trite and yeah. But I'd be lying if I said it wasn't watchable. Only parts. I was going to say it's inoffensive, but parts of it were offensive.
I think you can just like see everything coming a mile off, and that spoils most of it.
Yeah.
What did you make of Penelope Wilton's character?
I just wasn't on board with it. The whole performance of it, I wasn't on board with the writing of it.
Yeah,
it's just
shrewish.
She's just a completely, and it's not that the character is dislikable, because the character's supposed to be dislikable. It's that the character and the way the actress plays her amps that up so much. You wonder why Nye didn't divorce her 30 years ago, and because there's no backstory, because they've had to. Scrimp all this together at the beginning just to get them all out there, and it's an ensemble piece. There's nothing to underpin that. So you just got her being a complete character, and just thinking, well, why are you putting up with this? Why have you been putting up with this?
This is like if Owen Wilson had stayed with Rachel McAdams in Midnight in Paris 30 years later.
Yeah. So it when you've got that there's no real arc to it. It's just her being a character until the inevitable happens. And it's a shame, because Nye really does do what he can with a nothing character. But I can see why this would still be doing the rounds. I could see why this would word of mouth from a more elderly audience would keep this around.
I think people, it's sort of like a Love Actually for old people, but not written nearly half as well.
Well, yeah, and Love Actually was only half well written, because half the subplots don't work.
Yeah.
So about a quarter of this works. Moving on.
Next, we've got The Hunter, Australian film.
Yeah, I didn't know it was Australian. The only thing I knew about this film beforehand was that Willem Dafoe was in it.
Right.
So when it said Francis O'Connor next in the cast, my eyes just lit up, because I really, really do like it.
Yeah.
And have done in lots of things. She was really good in AI as the mom.
Yeah.
Mansfield Park, she's super. She's absolutely stunning in an Australian film called Blessed a couple of years ago. Her and Miranda Otto, both very good. But I was a bit sad to see that she's wasted. The basic plot of this is that Willem Dafoe is hired by a company to hunt down a Tasmanian tiger, which is thought to have been extinct, but there have been a couple of sightings, so they want him to go out there and capture some samples, which would allow them exclusivity in. You've got to think potential cloning or any use of the genetic material, which previously is thought to not exist anymore. So he's sent down to Tasmania, and he's put up in Francis O'Connor's shack. Would you describe it as a shack or a lodge?
I think it's a bit better than a shack. It's quite nice.
Between a shack and a lodge?
Yeah. It's a little hideaway.
A schlodge. Yeah, so he gets there, and she's out of it. Her husband's been missing since the previous year, and the two kids are running around effing and blinding and getting as naked as much as they can. And there may or may not be some competition for him to get the job done.
Yeah.
So, what did you think of this one then?
Well, firstly, do you know who wrote the book that this is based on?
I saw the IMDb page as well. Julia Lee.
Yes.
Who directed the fundamentally atrocious Sleeping Beauty last year.
Oh, fundamentally excellent. However you view that.
The fundamentally embarrassing that Jane Campion even put her name on the poster. Anyway.
I didn't know that she wrote books as well.
Apparently this was like over 10 years ago this book was written as well.
Right. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
I have very mixed feelings about this. I think it works on one level as a story about the hunting of the tiger. That side of things works really well. I don't think the relationship with the family works quite as well. A lot of it feels very sterile. Doesn't really move you the way it should.
Yeah.
Did you feel that?
Not quite as starkly, but I do get what you're saying. And I think the reason, the big reason why it doesn't move you is because there's so little characterization in terms of underpinning. So you don't know where he's been, you don't know where he's from, so he's a complete blank slate. And then you only get the lightest of skate jobs into the children and the mother's situation. So none of that's fleshed out because they do focus on the hunting so much.
Yeah, but that's the more interesting side to me. I mean, when he comes into the town, he gets kind of... You get that scene, the stranger entering the town and, like, the kind of ruffian townsfolk just kind of... Yeah.
I just thought that was just normal Australian hospitality.
It's sort of a... I was dying for him to do kind of a bad day at Black Rock.
Yes, yeah, I got that vibe. Yeah, I think for me, this thing is beautifully shot. The cinematography, I really did like.
It's beautiful,
and the score is. I love modern scores like this.
It's sort of like crackling fire. Kind of places the score.
Yeah, and it's. It's electronic without being electronica, and it's chilled out without being making the whole thing comatose. I like the tone that when you have that underpinning the visuals, that sort of suggests and gives you the atmosphere for the whole hunting side of it. I mean, because there's not much to that dramatically. So that's where the star really does underpin it well. The girl I'd seen before, she was in The Tree, the Charlotte Gainsbourg film from a couple of years ago.
Morgana?
Yeah.
Something or other. Davis?
Yeah. I want to say Davis. She was fine. She's the right side of not being punchable. Lad had nothing to do, and O'Connor really was wasted.
Because she's supposed to be. There's a part of it where they hint that she's had some kind of breakdown.
Yeah,
she's on pills or something, isn't she?
Yeah, and that's presumably because the husband's been missing since the previous summer.
Yeah.
But they don't go beyond that, and then they just. This is part of it as well, because they follow he goes every 12 days.
Yeah,
he goes for 12 days at a time up there, and so he's literally taken the pills off. He's done something with the pills and told the kid, basically she's going to go cold turkey. So he's told the kids what to do, and then of course when he gets back, you haven't seen any of that. So
once Defoe kind of returns each time, you don't really get a sense of connection between them.
No.
It's just the scenes are a little bit empty, and they kind of bored me.
I like watching Dafoe. I just think he's always really. I mean, this is guy who played Jesus.
One of the many.
He's got such a presence about his. I mean, he can hold a close up just of his face.
Yeah.
And
he's picking really interesting projects as well, which is good. He's working with a lot of different directors. He just did a Abel Ferrara film.
Oof.
Yeah. About the end of the world. He's worked with Italian directors lately. Saw a film at Venice. It was terrible, but
he was in it.
He was in it. But I just think he's just making. Because after Spider-Man, I think he just got sick of being.
Well, also, I mean, I suppose at the end of the day, if you've made enough money over your career, or if you're confident enough in your talent that you think, okay, I can get a few films every year and that'll just keep me ticking over, then why not do whatever you want? You don't always have to. I mean, he will have got paid up the ass for Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Fair play to him. I mean, there's no shame in taking the big paycheck at all. In fact, I mean, so that's why I don't criticise Scarlett Johansson for having done it. I mean, she's as we were saying the other week, she's not turned 30. Coin it in while you can, love. You're not gonna lose the talent, or well, maybe you have. I don't know. We'll have to see if she does anything else.
Well, she's got that under the skin coming out. Jonathan Glazer film. We'll see. But it's just a bit slow. Like, I think this like kind of a mini revelation that happens after about 70 minutes. I don't know if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Not the major spoiler, kind of like
the
mini.
The Bourne type thing, where it all goes a bit Jason Bourne, First Bourne identity.
Yeah, and just before then as well, when you find out about the like
company. Yes.
I just felt like that should have happened way before it did.
I
just waited far too long. Not a lot happened in the first hour.
No.
And it's a 90-minute film, so really, it should be a little bit more, a little bit more gradual.
Yeah, I suppose there are a lot of scenes of him setting traps in the woods.
Yeah, a lot of excuses for the great cinematography.
Yeah, I mean, it was very nice cinematography.
Yeah.
But no, I thought it was quite good. But without him, it would be a star below. He's one of those actors who elevates stuff just by being in it. And a lesser interesting actor would have made this a much less interesting film. Because it is about the style and him. There's not that much more on offer.
Yeah. I mean, in the last, 15-20 minutes, a lot kind of happens. It's like something kind of crazy happens, and then it's got kind of the end where he's, kind of sense of realisation about what the guy before him's gone through.
Mm-hmm.
And about the tiger, etc., which is really moving, I found.
Yeah.
I don't know.
You think it was a bit slow, rush?
Yeah. It was a bit hasty in the last third, I think. But he was good.
He was?
It was well directed. Well, you know, maybe not well edited, maybe well directed. and well shot.
Very, very. Right, so from there, from Australia, we are going to the inevitable French Quarter.
Yeah. It's a regular occurrence.
It is a regular occurrence. We can't get around it because it's Britain. We get French films all the time. So first one is a film that's been kicking around for quite a few weeks at the art houses, The Fairy, which is... do you want to go through this one? The basic plot setup?
You can.
You'll let me.
You know about the trio or whatever they are.
Yeah, this is a Belgian Antipodean dance duo, Fiona Gordon and Dominique Abel, and they make these very quirky little films with the feature dance scenes throughout. And so very kitschy type things. There was one a couple of years ago called Rumba, which did the rounds on the art house circuit. And so this one is about a guy who's a night porter at a hotel in France. Mm-hmm. And he meets a fairy, and she gives him three wishes, and the film is him basically going through that. He falls in love with her, and it's basically him trying to figure out what his third wish is going to be. Or that's the teaser on it. So yeah, so it's the same sort of style, very quirky, very twee, and lots of dance sequences thrown in. I think inevitably with this sort of thing, it's hit and miss.
Yeah.
And even if you like it, it's hit and miss. And it's a bit of a scattergun approach. You could have 100 people in this in a cinema watching this, and if you gave out scorecards, you'd get everything from 1 to 10.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people would be put off by it because it's kind of relentlessly twee and very precocious.
Very knowing.
Yeah. Like,
very
it starts off with a recurring joke kind of at the beginning.
Yeah, he's trying to eat your sandwich, he keeps on getting interrupted.
Yeah, and it felt a bit like it should have been a short film.
Yeah.
Like a 20-25 minute short film.
Or like Pina has a collection of dance sequences.
Maybe, yeah.
Mind you, it would probably be less appalling than Pina was, but that's another story for another podcast. Wenders, you bastard.
Wenders. I'm not going to slag this off much because A, I didn't get to the end, and B, I feel a bit mean-spirited because it is really kind of...
It's trying to be entertaining in its own little way.
Yeah. It's cheerful.
Mm.
Which is
it requires a complete, and people it might sound a bit strange coming from me, but it does require a complete lack of cynicism.
Yeah.
And you have to be in that mood watching it. You can be a not very cynical person anyway, but just have, if you've just got even a slightest bit of cynicism about this, then you could very easily just cross your arms and switch off and go, no.
Yeah.
Not having this.
Say it like, maybe have a glass of red wine with it, or...
Yeah, this isn't... Well, sometimes I describe this stuff as a Sunday evening film, which is where I think you should have like the more like serious... so if you're going to watch a Holocaust film, that for me is a Sunday evening film. This, I've no idea when you'd watch this.
Yeah. Maybe if you're a morning person.
Yeah, maybe like 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning.
Yeah. Before you put the washing out.
But yeah, so I like the dance sequences. I think the longer it went, the more I got on board with the cutesy, quirky style. I was with you at the beginning. I think that some of the stuff was overdone and a bit laboured. But
it's gimmicky.
Yeah, but in general, I don't think it was as... I don't think the dance sequences were as good as Rumba, but I think overall the narrative, even though it's not the strongest narrative in the world, I think the narrative was better in this one. So, yeah, I liked it as far as it went. But
did you like the structure of the three wishes? And...
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, it's helped move it along. More than their other films have, where they did tend to stodge down a bit. I would recommend that people just check this out, because I've got no idea if you'd like it or not, in a good way. Because sometimes you watch a film and you think, well, I've got no idea who's going to like that, in a bad way, because you think, oh, I couldn't recommend it to anyone. Whereas,
yeah.
But with something like this, I think, well, you know what? Yeah, have a look. You might like it. So it's not in a bad way. Which is kind of like our next film, Le Havre, Aki Carries Maki. He's an acquired taste.
Finnish, is he?
Yes. I know he's been Oscar nominated. I don't think it won. That would have been 2002.
Yeah.
For The Man Without a Past. Kati Utinen won, who's in this film, won Best Actress at Cannes for that, and it's one of the biggest joke wins that really? They've ever done. But it wasn't a strong year for that they had to go on. And she was basically a supporting actress in it. But yeah, it's you look at it and you just think, how'd you go for this, boys? Did you see this one?
No.
No,
I didn't
okay,
have
so
enough
I'll,
time. I had
yeah,
to
yeah,
watch I'll, another one instead.
Yeah, that's fine. So I'll run through this quick briefly. This is about a local bloke in Le Havre who's a shoe shiner. And it's this policeman running around at Jean-Pierre Darroussin, were brilliant French character actor who's been in pretty much everything. Last thing I saw him in was The Well Digger's Daughter, which he was absolutely great in. Was it Daniel O'Toole in Conversation with My Gardener? Lovely performance. He was a really good actor.
Yeah.
So he's a policeman on the lookout for a young African lad who's container has been discovered with a load of people trying to emigrate to England. This seems to be a common theme for French films.
Yeah, they're all trying to come here, but why?
Yeah, yeah, the extra £10 a week, that's what it is. Don't underestimate it. So they've discovered, the police discover this container full of illegal immigrants, and the lad gets away, so the lad's on the run. The shoeshine guy, his wife, Kati Utinen, and is in hospital, has to go to hospital, and shoeshine guy starts taking care of it and hiding the lad who's on the run. I've seen a couple of Carrie Mackie films, Remember That Past and Lights in the Dusk, beautifully shot Lights in the Dusk, oh, gorgeous scene. He is an acquired taste, and I think I didn't find this one very funny. It is a comedy. It's Scandinavian comedies can be a bit strange,
right?
With their tone, very dark, very odd, and
like Lazarescu kind of thing.
Kind of, yeah. It's the sort of thing where you watch it and you're in that in the Lazarescu way, in that you watch it and you're in that realm which you're not usually in, and it's a realm in and of itself.
You feel a bit like removed from it, or
yeah, and sometimes it can be very funny. Lights in the Dusk is about a gangster's mole, and it's brilliant because she's like this glamorous femme fatale who's trying to seduce this hapless bloke into doing something, and then it cuts back to her with the gangsters, and she's doing the hoovering, and they're treating her like a housewife. So it's that sort of juxtaposition. So with these Carrie Mackie films, The Fairy, it's hit and miss. Narrative isn't great in a different way because it's not exactly unpredictable. But it's it is one that I would say check out because you might like it. I wasn't the biggest fan of it. I think it's okay.
I might check out.
Yeah,
I've actually been to Le Havre.
Mm,
and
really?
I can understand why somebody would want to leave.
These two would actually make a very good double bill. Similar sort of things going on. Mm. And similarly acquired tastes. Right, so from that to something that I'm pretty sure we're not going to be giving any best awards to.
Yeah.
But we'll see. This is God Bless America, and Cal's going to tell you a bit about it.
Yeah. Firstly, we have to give props to director Bobcat Goldthwaite for having...
A.K.A. Officer Zed from the Police Academy movies.
Really?
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
That explains it.
It really does.
So is he called Bobcat in...
No, he's Zed in the he's the he goes, ah, the guy with the long hair, the rocker, he's in like 2, 3, and 4. You can hardly understand a word he's saying. So he's the Robert something, so Bobcat's obviously his nickname, and he's obviously used that as his stage name. I think he's a comedian,
right?
Did a bit of stand up
successful, well, have to, maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah, but he wrote and directed this, and it stars Joel Murray, who I've heard of for some reasons. I don't know why.
He was in Dharma and Greg, but he's been in some films. He's been bit parts in films, but he was one of the recurring roles in Dharma and Greg.
Right.
He's very funny in that.
And it stars Tara Lynn Barr, who I'm guessing is a newcomer.
Yeah, I had a look. She's done a couple of things, but it's usually like one-off TV stuff.
Yeah, and it's about a man who's divorced, loses his job, and is diagnosed with a brain tumour.
So he feels like Andy Murray did on Sunday.
Yeah, not quite that bad. So he's disillusioned with life, and he's disillusioned with pop culture and the American media and reality shows and talent shows and kind of the ethics of America.
And shock jocks.
Yeah.
The media in general.
And it eventually leads him to murder this kind of reality show celebrity. And after he does that, he kind of recruits... Well, he doesn't recruit. She kind of...
Recruits herself.
Yeah. This teenage girl kind of joins him on his travels, and they kind of go on a crusade to kind of murder...
bad people.
Yeah. Did we like this? I think we know the answer, right?
This has
positive response, can I just say?
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
If you asked me after half an hour, I said, good God, no.
Yeah.
Because I think it's set up, it takes a good half hour to actually get the girl in. And before that, it's just this guy who's whining and there's nothing...
The first 20-25 minutes is basically a succession of like kind of representations of pop culture,
along with him whinging about representations of pop culture and fantasizing about killing people.
Yeah, I mean it's boring because like this is kind of a stance that I'm kind of in favor of generally, but it's just the way that they kind of portray it. Just gets really annoying at the beginning.
Yeah, it's like people at his work hanging around just chatting about stuff, saying the exact same thing I just heard on the radio, and he's dreaming about shooting them.
And he has a conversation with a guy. No self-respecting guy's going to be that defensive of American Idol or whatever.
Yeah, that was one where as Joel was delivering that particular speech, I could hear the keys of Bobcat writing it.
Yeah,
it didn't really sit with me well as like a piece of natural writing. But once the girl turns up, it picks up.
I think because of their relationship.
Yeah, she brings a bit of charm into it. It gets a bit funnier. It gets a bit sillier. Because beforehand it's just like, okay, you got like a shot of him like shooting a newborn baby or a young baby, and it just comes across as maddeningly distasteful.
Yeah.
Whereas once she comes along, it goes way more tongue in cheek. But
although
still,
her lusting after him is a bit distasteful.
Well, they're going around killing people for being noisy in the cinema. It's not. It's not taste. I was watching this and I just couldn't. I remember when Natural Born Killers came out, the massive stink that I mean, that was unbelievable, that fuss that was made about that film.
Controversial.
In 1994. Oh, it was incredible. It was, this is essentially Natural Born Killers, way more over the top, but with a lot of social comment. And I do think a little bit. He's there whining about all this like right wingness and how lowest common denominator. But then he is lowest common denominating it himself in what he's actually doing in this film.
Yeah.
So I do think it's there's a little bit of it that's like, well,
yeah, it's a little
really heavy cake.
Self-reflective.
He wants to have his cake and eat it. He wants to have a go at them doing all these things, but then doing similar sort of things himself, because he's being extraordinarily judgmental. And maybe, and that it probably is his point, that if they can, if the media is going to do this and tell you to think this way, and everyone's going to be, then I can do it as well the other way around.
It is that kind of thing where it's always the loner that he has to have all these things happen to him for it to happen.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What do you think about the use of the brain tumour?
Predictable.
Terrible.
Predictably, it's just, yeah, it's a plot device. This is the other side of it, because it sets up that he's got his ex-wife, his kid hates him. His ex-wife's about to get remarried. You can just feel it piling on, and you don't actually feel it naturally for the character. You just think this is the writer piling it on for him so he can go somewhere.
Yeah.
And then so with the brain tumor, it just felt like, okay, this is the extra bit push that the writer feels that the character needs before he breaks. So it doesn't feel natural at all. And then the resolution of that just doesn't feel unpredictable at all. So
and nobody is safe from criticism in this, right?
No.
They even have a pop of Bowie, for God's sake.
They do have a pop of Bowie. They have a go at. There's one character which they go after, who's obviously supposed to be someone like Glenn Beck or someone like that on Fox News. I mean, this is Bob Goldthwait. He's obviously sees all this stuff on TV and just wants to have a whine about it. So he's made a film about somebody who goes around offing all these people, because that's probably what he wants to do when he sat there. But quite simply, you don't. Okay, fine. So I personally don't watch X Factor. I don't watch Britain's Got Talent. I don't watch any of it. I just choose not to watch it. There are other
ways
to entertain yourself.
Do you watch
that? I watch Dancing on Ice.
Yeah.
I watch Dancing on Ice because I like ice skating. Always have done. But that's because I choose to watch it. So all the rest of it, my brother actually checks when he's talking about someone who he knows is like in the paper every day, or in the tabloids every day, and because there's some reality star, he checks to see if I know who they are before he wants to talk about it, and usually I don't. You can avoid it. I mean, okay, fine, that's our country. It is a different culture. I do take that on board, and we don't have the whole shock jock with the xenophobia and the extreme distastefulness that goes on there. I get that's a different part of the culture, but you don't have to listen to the radio in the car. You can slap on a CD.
Yeah.
You don't have to watch singing programs on Saturday night. You can go watch a film. Yeah. You can put on the Discovery Channel. So I do think that the character, I mean, they haven't really set up why. I mean, they set up the character as a loser very well, but why he then has to sit watching, flicking through TV, flicking through TV channels that he hates. Wouldn't you flick through TV channels that you like?
Yeah. But there are so many confrontations that he has with, like, pop culture that just feels too much. And just...
Mm. It's a whinge fest.
Yeah. It comes
much like this podcast.
Crass, just really... Much like what?
Much like this podcast, it's a whinge fest.
This week, yeah. I don't think I let any of these films this week.
No.
Oh dear.
who'd think it'd be me finding the positive in almost everything?
Yeah, that's true.
This is the thing. I'm a naturally positive guy. I actively dislike very few things. Well, unless they're directed by Lars von Trier. dear. Back to the Oscars. So, Oscar-winning film out next week. Re-release. Another re-release.
Yeah.
Chariots of Fire.
Presume for the Olympics.
It's there for the Olympics, and it's being pimped quite heavily in the cine world, at least at the times I've been recently. Have you seen the trailer when you've been out and about?
I've seen it before.
The trailer before or the film before?
Both.
Oh, right, cool. Mm. Yeah, lots of havers in the trailer. Don't remember, and they cut out all the Gilbert and Sullivan. Wonder why that is.
Havers, he's not in it that much, is he? Right?
No, he's
like
not.
Half
he's
an hour? Kind of.
Tops.
Yeah.
Tops. He's nice in it, though. Nice performance.
Cute.
He's a very handsome man back in the day. But then again, so he, apparently it was his character in real life that did the quad race against the clock.
Right.
So this is the thing with Chariots of Fire. Chariots of Fire is one of the best examples of a film that when it diverts away from what really happened, it does so to improve the drama in the film, and that's what I'm completely on board with. It's like the King's Speech. The King's Speech, the Stuttering King had actually done a speech in the 20s, unstuttered. But if you put that in, then it disrupts the arc. It makes much more sense within the arc of the film, The King's Speech, to have the first time he does it be when it's actually needed in the time of war, etc., etc. It's more satisfying dramatically. So with this, there are various things like that. So they have, instead of having him, who's just a supporting character who they're not interested in doing the quad race, they have to race the clock chiming. It takes like 43 seconds to chime, and you've got to do like 400 metres or whatever it is. So they have Abrahams do it instead. That makes it, it ties it in with him. That makes it better. And the whole I won't race on a Sunday, apparently in real life they knew about this months and months before. In the film they find out on the boat on the way over there. It's more dramatic. That's fine. You don't have to, it's only a slight tweak, and it improves the drama. I've got no problem with it.
Right.
The most interesting thing about the characters here is what's not in the film. The character that Eric Little plays ended up being a prisoner of war in the war, and the British government negotiated for his release. I think this is in Southeast Asia somewhere, and he refused.
Right.
He said, "I'm not going until everyone. I'm not going to be released until everyone else is released." And he died before the end of the war. That just shows the character of the man. I mean, if you've seen the film, you can completely believe it.
I mean, the film, is it set in the 20s or something?
Yes.
Yeah. It was not what I expected when I went to see it, because when you see all the iconic imagery...
And sounds.
Yeah. And the score. And you see, like, you expect it to be more sporting. I mean... It's like more of a traditional depiction of sport, and it's more, it's showing sport, a different side of sport. More so it's like drawing rooms, and it's a little bit stuffy at times. Mm. But I thought it was interesting that it kind of showed sport in that way, and not through to the traditional formula of round, victory,
yeah.
Victory, victory.
Yeah. It goes about it in different ways. There are little things that this film does that I really, really like. I love the scene where Ian Holmes sat on his bed listening to, and because he back then coaches couldn't go into the stadium, so he's just sat in his bed and he hears the British national anthem and realizes that Harold's actually won, and then punches through the straw hat. I love Holmes in this film. But it did things in the early 80s that such a big deal was made out of Sofia Coppola using rock music for a period piece in Marie Antoinette, and here is a film in 1980 which is a period film using a synthetic score, all electronics Vangelis score.
Yeah,
that's unusual.
Well. I think I have heard like scores from that from the 80s, but they were in like horror films, you know, like
Vangelis did Blade Runner as well, didn't he?
Yeah, like James Herbert kind of films.
Mm.
But yeah, there's a lot of like hidden kind of jealousy in it.
I think. You wonder what I mean. Obviously, Ian Charleston died in the late 80s. I think Ian McKellen said that his Hamlet was the best he'd ever seen.
That's high praise.
Well, it is. Yeah, I think it was his Hamlet. Ben Cross is just born for that role.
Yeah.
For that role.
It's not a very active role.
No,
for a lead.
but it has a lot of it require. He smoulders well in it because it is, like you said, the jealousy, and he's got the anti-Semitism, which completely goes over your head when you watch this when you're a kid.
Yeah.
It's there straight from the beginning when he was signing, when he's like signing in as Abraham's, even the guy on the door signing him in, making comments, but Borg Queen Alice Krieg as his girlfriend. That's crazy looking back.
The what queen?
The Queen of the Borg in Star Trek. The actress who plays her is the Alice Krieg is the is Abraham's girlfriend in this.
And was she already in Star Trek before this?
Oh no, this was like 15 years later. She did Star Trek.
Oh right.
Because she's like shaved head. The Queen of the Borg. Mm. But no, so this is. What were you going to say?
I was going to say, is this one of your favourite?
Yes.
Sporting films of just films, period.
One of my favourite films, full stop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Best picture.
Of that year.
Of any year.
It's one of the few I agree with.
Right.
Yeah.
Comprehensively, you're saying.
Oh well, yeah, and that's
your best is the best.
Yes. Yeah. That's me being anal about that. Yeah. So I think. The other ones, I used to have Unforgiven for years and years and years, but then I saw The Best Intentions.
Like The Crying Game?
No.
Do you not think that's better than Unforgiven?
No, because I'd had it spoiled, and I love Unforgiven. I really do. And I think it's because I grew up on Unforgiven. It's one of my one of the films my grandfather. But he used to go out and just buy VHSs from Asda for like 13 quid back in the early 90s. He'd just come back with them. He didn't like JFK. That's how I saw JFK.
Yeah.
And so it's just one of those that I just really, really love. But I do like The Crying. I probably need to rewatch The Crying Game, but I actually think that Stephen Ray is probably super. My pick for actor that year.
Yeah.
Even though everyone goes on about Denzel and
I think
Pacino, or now that he's become popular again, Robert Downey Jr., I think. Smokes them all.
Yeah. Or I can't remember if I've got him or Tim Robbins in the player.
Yeah.
But one of
them. Oh yeah. Oh sorry, I meant of the nominees. Yeah. You've got Jack Lemmon, Gary Glenn Ross that year as well. Super in that.
Good year.
Super. Very. Very.
But
yes.
Yeah. I like Chariots of Fire, but I think it suffers a little bit because I'm not a fan of kind of. It reminded me of like Passage to India a little bit.
Okay. Yeah, I only saw that very recently, actually.
Yeah. Obviously not like lean use of the landscape a little bit more, but they just had the same kind of colour saturation, that kind of thing. Just felt a little bit kind of long and dull in places.
Too many sermons.
Oh, maybe. But it's very appropriate. It's kind of good for a re-release this year when the Olympics is here.
It's a nice touch. It's a nice touch. Right, so based on Chariots of Fire coming out, we're going to go through our top three sport films. And that is we're going to take a wide net on that.
Are we?
We can do.
Is there a controversy coming up?
No. Okay. No. And I've already said that Chariots of Fire is one of my absolute favourite films, so I'm going to exclude it from mine because we're just going to assume.
Well,
we have
talked about it enough, so it's fine.
Yeah.
So I was combing my lists for the ones that were in my top 10 from each year. I looked at every single year.
Yeah.
So I got three, and they weren't the three I was expecting. But
oh, okay.
You know.
Yeah.
Okay, so do you want to go first?
Okay, I'll go first this week. This is I'm gonna pick one or the other. They're both kitchen sink films.
Just say them both. It's fine.
And I'm gonna go with This Sporting Life. It's about rugby league.
Yeah.
Richard Harris is a rugby league player. The other one, which I was sort of thinking of, is Loneless, the long distance runner.
Right.
Tom Courtney.
Was that that's the year before, right?
It's around the same. It's like Room at the Top was 59, Saturday Night Sunday Morning was 60, Taste of Honey was 61, then this Sporting Life was 62, Loneliness 63, or the other way around. It's literally one per year.
Yeah. Both leads are nominated for Oscars.
Yep. Yeah. Rachel Roberts and Richard Harris. Rachel Roberts only lost. Mate, you never know with the Americans, but she lost because Patricia Neal wasn't put in supporting for Hood. That's the main reason why she didn't win.
Yeah.
She might not have won anyway. You never know with those guys. So it's hard film, as my father would say, hard film. This Sporting Life, it's not fun at all. But
is it domestic abuse?
Yeah. It's just the whole domestic situation. Gritty. It's a kitchen sink film, but it's the grittiest kitchen sink film. Yes.
So what about the sporting side of it then? Is that?
It's a lot of rugby league. He's a rugby league professional, and he gets into a relationship with Rachel Roberts. So there are quite a few scenes of him like becoming a star on the pitch. And for all those people who complain about the Americans using the word soccer, the British kitchen in this kitchen sink film used soccer a lot. Because that's
why that is.
Because it's talking about football, rugby football, as opposed to association football, and that's where soccer comes from. Association soccer.
I see. Association is more working class, right?
Yeah.
And it's from the clubs.
Yeah, and difference between rugby league and rugby union is literally a north-south divide.
Yeah.
Pretty much. With the Midlands counting as the south. So what's your number three then?
My number three is The Fighter.
Ah.
Which surprised me a little because I gave it an A-, so.
Right,
that's
okay.
Just thought it was.
Amy Adams, we've got her in again.
Yes. She's made 2 weeks in a row.
That's my girl.
And the whole ensemble is just brilliant in this film. Maybe apart from Mark Wahlberg, but he's fine.
I thought you were going to say Bale.
No. You like Bale in this, right?
Quite. I didn't dislike him.
Yeah.
I liked him a bit. I liked him a bit in this.
The direction of the cast is just really well done. It's a kind of film that I can imagine completely like failing.
If you actually know who Mickey Ward was.
Yeah, maybe. But just because all the performances in it are so huge, apart from Mark Wahlberg, that it could easily just go into chaos. But I think
he often does that, plays just as a selfless role and just anchors it solidly while everyone else comes around him to play.
Yeah, like Boogie Nights.
Yeah.
Although, he's a little bit more volatile in Booty Nights sometimes, but
that's one that's more about the sporting.
Yeah. Surprised, but I think it was my favourite American film of 2009. So
right.
I think it's like my number six of the year.
Okay. Like there's a outside possibility you might have this one. My number two.
Mm-hmm.
Bull Durham.
No, but that was my number four.
Okay, yeah. I've actually read the screenplay for this, and it's just such a brilliant piece of writing. I'm not sure if you have to like baseball to love this film, but I don't think you have to like baseball to like this film. Costner back when he was relevant. Susie Sarandon, rarely better, and it's Tim Robbins, flat out hilarious.
Yeah, it's not that much about baseball, really. Like, there's a kind of a divide between.
Yeah, it's a love triangle with baseball as the backdrop.
Yeah,
and underpinning everything, and it's a very amusing film, and it's the sort of one that outlives any awards it may or may not have gotten.
We did get any. Okay. This one did, I think. My number two is Breaking Away from 1979.
Oh, yeah.
Nominated for Best Picture in 1979.
I've never seen that one actually.
Oh, well, it's really good. It's about this cycling kind of quartet.
Oh, that's right. It's about cycling. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's in this, like, I think it's Indiana or Illinois. It's some, like, kind of smallish state. And they're kind of up against it. And in that way, it's kind of, it is quite formulaic, but it's really, I think it captures the era really well. And the kind of, the whole kind of dazed and confused vibe of kind of being like 18, 19 and in kind of small town away from everywhere. And it's just great. Really check it out.
Right. Okay, so my number one is obviously The Blind Side. I mean...
oh my God.
No,
can we put a ban on that? Those three words, please.
Yeah. Well, you didn't expect me to say Wildcats, did you?
I don't know whether you're going to... It's between two. I don't know what you're going to say.
What do you think I'm going to say?
I think there's a highbrow pick and there's a lowbrow pick here.
Okay, what do you think the lowbrow pick is?
I think the lowbrow pick is Tin Cup.
No, but I do love Tin Cup. The lowbrow pick would have been, if I was going that way, would have been Escape to Victory.
Oh, right, okay.
Well, you got Ozzy Ardiles and Sylvester Stallone in goal and Bobby Moore and Pele in the same team. It's hilarious. Michael Caine. It's brilliant. And Max von Sydow as the chief Nazi. Great. what do you think the highbrow pick is?
Well, I don't know, because that's what...
Okay. Well, it's the obvious boring. Raging Bull.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the same as me.
Yeah. Well, it's what hasn't been said about it. Just for the editing of the fight sequences alone. Just, like, apparently Scorsese had like a flame underneath the camera to just give it the sort of the tricks that he does in that film, just to get you all these artificial tricks. Like the slow motion and that sort of thing and everything, but what all these artificial fake things do is give you a very real glimpse into what it's actually like to be in the ring, in a way that I think something like The Wrestler, professional wrestling is predetermined, I think that gives you a very real idea of what it's physically like to be in the ring as a wrestler. This is does that and more for the boxing, using the artificiality to make it real.
Yeah, and really for a black and white film as well.
Ballsy, and apparently he did that because he was so disenchanted with the quality of the film stock that was around at the time, and he was just thinking,
how times have changed.
Exactly. Exactly, but I think I remember. It might have been Wendy Ide's review of Sherry, and she was talking about Rupert Friend. Second mention on the podcast here for Rupert. She said that the problem comes when the writing fails to elevate a unlikable character into a fascinating one, and that is this film. Thoroughly detestable man. Thoroughly compelling.
Definitely.
In the story.
Alluring and kind of even.
Yeah.
Times.
And the genius bit of trivia that apparently when LaMotta actually watched the film with one of his ex-wives, he looked at it, said, "Was I really like that?" And she goes, "No, you were much worse." But your thoughts?
Yeah, it's just, I think it's my second favourite Scorsese film.
What's the first?
Taxi Driver.
Ah. I on some days I'd go Age of Innocence, actually.
Okay.
Some days.
There are a few to choose from.
Well, yeah.
But it's a huge performance. Huge.
Oh, yeah.
It's amazing. And the fact that it's black and white and a lot of boxing films rely on kind of gruesome.
Yeah, know. The blood. And
yeah,
and
this is not like that at all. It is really artistic when you look at it closely.
especially when you think about how Taxi Driver, the end of Taxi Driver, had to be, had to desaturate the colour because it was too shocking. You sort of, you're glad he did this in black and white and didn't have any fake looking blood. Possibly.
Yeah.
Possibly might have had something to do with it. But El Super Classico.
Wow.
Two film geeks waxing lyrical over Raging Bull. Who'd have thought it?
This may have been the first time we agree.
Well, you're thoroughly on something being brilliant, yeah. Certainly, certainly. It's taken 6 weeks. So join us in 6 weeks' time for when we actually think something is good again.
Yeah. Only happens once in the blue moon. We have a blog.
As ever.
It's still there.
Yeah.
Moodforpodcast@blogspot.com.
We have a Twitter account, Moodforpodcast.
Yep. We are on iTunes.
On each of our blogs. There are various ways of getting hold of us.
Yep.
So check us out.
Next week, we have two of your favourite topics.
Amy Adams and Judy Greer.
No, but close. Those would be male strippers and Keira Knightley.
Oh, right. Can I phone in the substitute next week? Can we get my dad to come in and talk about Lindsay Lohan and Dolly Parton?
That sounds like a party.
Together, you waltz right in the door, just like you've done before, and wrap my heart round your little finger. Here you come again, just when I'm about to make it work without you. You look into my eyes and lie those pretty lies, and pretty soon I'm wondering.